Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here in this prestigious place. And this morning when I was sitting at the breakfast table in my bed and breakfast, there was a German couple, and of course we had some discussion, and they asked me what I'm doing here. I said I'm here for professional reasons at Fields Institute, and they did not have any idea what this is. Can you imagine such a crazy thing? So I had to explain them. I don't have to explain it to you, of course, and the subject of this talk is well summarized by the title, I think. In my opinion, geometric inequalities have played a major role in stochastic geometry for many years, and I want to explain one of these relationships, which goes back some time, and also some new relationships which actually motivated new geometric inequalities. So let me set the stage. And our basic object, which we will mainly study throughout, is a so-called hyperplane process. So capital X is a stationary, to be more precise, Poisson, sometimes towards the end I will drop the Poisson assumption, Poisson hyperplane process. And to draw a picture, this can be visualized in the following way, say in the plane for n equal 2, and now the hyperplanes are lines. We consider more abstractly random counting measures. It's an object like that. That this is a point mass sitting at a hyperplane Hi. And more intuitively, you can think of this as a random collection of hyperplanes. So each realization is such a collection, and stationary means that the distribution is invariant under translations of this X. And the Poisson assumption means something which I will explain in a moment, probably most of you will know anyway. But thinking of this as a measure has the advantage that, of course, everything lives on an underlying probability space, which I will not mention in the following, that we can write the expectation of X in this way, and this is now a measure on the space of hyperplanes. Yeah? And the stationarity implies that this measure is translation invariant. Now we have to know how do the translation invariant measures on the space of hyperplanes look like. And there's a nice description. So the integration can actually be decomposed in the translational and the directional part. And here we have hyperplanes with normal vector u, distance t from the origin, and they should lie in some given Borel set. We integrate with respect to some measure phi and along the normal like that. So if this is the origin, here's the normal, we integrate for given u in this direction, so we can interchange, of course, integration to make this interpretation more rigorous. But since we want to have this measure phi also a probability measure, we have to write a constant in the front of this double integral, and this will be called, for intuitive reasons, the direction distribution of the hyperplane process, and this can be chosen as an even probability measure on the unit sphere, and this is called the intensity of this hyperplane process. And it gives, in a sense, the density of the hyperplanes. So in the average, it's the mean number of hyperplanes hitting a test set, basically speaking. So there are two special cases I should mention right now. If phi is spherical Lebesgue measure, so rotation invariant, then this measure will be rotation invariant, and due to the Poisson assumption, this has the effect of making X distributionally rotation invariant. And the converse is also true. And the other special case, which will be important in the following, is if phi is a discrete measure, then we will only have finitely many directions in every realization of our hyperplane process. Yeah? Can you imagine that's important that we understand this from the very beginning, because that's the basic object to work with. Okay, now if we look at this object, then it induces in the space a tessellation just by throwing these hyperplanes, and each realization at which we look as the origin in one of these cells which are induced. And we call that now the zero cell. And as you probably remember, there have been many confusions with Matthias and Rolf Schneider on the shape of such cells if some site condition is given, say the volume of these cells is large. So we'll not talk about this topic today. But still to begin, I will give some older results concerning the number of vertices of the zero cell. So that's denoted in this way, and that's a random variable and can adopt any value greater or equal than 3. So 3, 4, 5, everything is fine. But on the average, not all these values will be adopted. So the mean number of vertices in the plane is known to lie between 4 and I think pi squared over 2. And that's a special case of a theorem going back to Chandiaka, who proved the following. This number always lies between 2 to the n and n factorial over 2 to the n kappa n squared. Kappa n is the volume of the unit ball. And as you're all geometers, you immediately realize that there's some geometry in the background because these numbers cannot just be by chance. And actually, these bounds are also sharp. Equality occurs on the right-hand side isn't only if x is, in a sense, isotropic, so the distribution is rotation invariant. And here we have equality isn't only if every realization only has n directions, and it's the same for every realization. So it's a so-called parallel mosaic. And I will give indicate an argument which shows why this is true, because this gives the opportunity to introduce an important object in this framework, which we will use later anyway. So we have here non-trivial and non-convex object, these hyperplanes. And amazingly, Mataron has the idea of associating with such an object a convex body, which is actually a solenoid, and therefore it's called the associated solenoid of X, and it's defined by its support function. So we take the ingredients, namely the intensity and the direction distribution, and then define it as follows. So that's certainly just by definition the support function of a solenoid with generating measure gamma over 2 times phi. Now, how does this help in proving these estimates? So first, one can write this number of vertices maybe in a more complicated way by summing over all n tuples of hyperplanes which occur in such a realization, and we do not repeat permutations, but such that the intersection is in general positions over points. And if this intersection point lies outside, it doesn't contribute, so it's the Euler characteristic. If it's lying inside, then it must be a boundary point, actually. So we just count in a complicated way the number of boundary points. And at this point, we need basic properties of Poisson process, like this Leibniz-Meca theorem, some integral geometry, and then we can rewrite this in the following way. So the mean volume of the zero cell times the volume of the associated solenoid pi sub x. So in a sense, this quantity takes care of the translations if the directions are fixed, and this quantity takes care of the directional distribution, in a sense. Amazingly, these two things are now just realized as a product. The second observation which we need is that if we look at the support function of pi x in direction u, then it's again a random variable. And its distribution is an exponential distribution, which is easy to see from the Poisson assumption, with parameter gamma times, of Z0, of the zero cell, with parameter pi x direction u. And this can be used to show that this mean volume is up to a constant, just the volume of the polar of the associated solenoid times the volume of this. So now we get the volume product of this associated solenoid. And at that point, everybody knows in this room that there are two famous inequalities, namely the Blaschke-Santalow inequality, which holds for all centrally symmetric convex bodies or homogeneous bodies, which gives now that this is bounded from above by kappa n squared, so we get the upper bound. And, you know, for solenoids, this is bounded from below by the corresponding volume product of the cube. So the value is 4 to the n over n factorial, and this cancels the factorial and gives the upper bound here. And even we get some information about the equality case from the corresponding information here. And of course, there was some story in the beginning. Shlomo proved actually the lower bound, the Mahler conjecture, by using random polytopes, but in a different way. And then John Diaca reversed the game after Shlomo Reisner, Mathieu Meillet, and Jan Boren found a different and more geometric, simpler proof of the Mahler conjecture for solenoids. So, quite recently, I worked with Karoly Borowski on stability results in geometry, and this motivated us to ask the question, so what happens if you know that the mean number of vertices is roughly 2 to the n, or roughly n factorial 2 to the n times kappa n squared. And it's clear that you can answer these questions, or can hope to answer these questions, as soon as you have stability results for this volume product. And fortunately, Karoly had proved something like that 2 years ago, and had shown actually for channel bodies, but as stated, only for centrally symmetric ones. So if K is a centrally symmetric convex body, epsilon is some fixed number between 0 and 1 half, say. And if we know that the volume product of K is close to the upper bound, and then in the Banach-Mazur distance, the distance between K and the ball must be small, so don't take logarithms, therefore the 1 plus some constant beta times epsilon 1 over 3n log epsilon 1 over 3, so something like that. In any case, the exponents are not optimal, and as Artyom said yesterday, these constants here are very bad. And the corresponding result holds if K is a solenoid, and epsilon, again, is some fixed number between 0 and 1. And if you know that the volume product of K is close to the lower bound, which I express in this way, then the Banach-Mazur distance between K and a cube is again small in this sense. So we can write the epsilon without exponent if we use results by people here in the room. And if you don't want to do that, because then we get some more information about the size of these constants, then we have to write a 1 over n here. But still, if you combine this with this representation there and use some stability results for the cosine transform, then you finally find the stability results for this problem from geometric probability. Which now can be stated as follows. If we know that the average number of vertices, say, is close to the upper bound, so then there exists numerical constants depending on the dimension, and there exists some general linear map, alpha, such that the Wasserstein or Wasserstein distance of, say, the direction distribution of the transformed hyperplane process, alpha x, from normalized spherical bed measure is small, namely at most some constant C of n times epsilon to the 1 over 6 n squared. So that's one result. So in a sense, it says if we are close to the upper bound with the mean number of vertices, then the direction distribution must be almost spherical back measure, almost rotation invariant. And this is quantified in this way. And if we know that this number of vertices is close to the lower bound, so say less or equal 1 plus epsilon times 2 to the n, then again, there exists some other constants, and the numbers lambda 1 up to lambda n, which are positive and linearly independent unit vectors, such that the measure rho, which is formed from these data, which is a discrete measure having point measures at bi plus minus and weights lambda I. This is a probability measure, and it's again close. So the given phi of x is close to rho in the Wasserstein distance, now with some better exponents, say 1 over 4 plus n. So this gives some information, and it shows the interaction between geometric problems and results in stochastic geometry. So that's one example, and at that point we have already seen that introducing some auxiliary bodies like this solenoid is a really great idea. I can say that because it was not my idea. It was due to Mataran and dates back to the 740, something like that. So now we study a new question. And this is joint work with Rolf. Maybe that's two. So again, we have x. And so it's a stationary Poisson hyperplane process. And we have intensity gamma and the action distribution phi. So it's the same as before. And once we have such an object, we can create new things out of it. Say we can take intersections of any two of these lines in the plane or hyperplanes in space. In the plane, it will give us points. In higher dimensions, it will give us lower dimensional flats. If we take any two hyperplanes, it will give n minus two flats. If we iterate this, say more generally, if you want to introduce section processes of different orders, so x1 is the process itself, and x sub k, roughly speaking, is obtained if we intersect any k hyperplanes, and we sum over all hyperplanes in x, for which this intersection gives us an n minus k flat, so if the hyperplanes are in general position, and we do not repeat permutations of the HI. And it's clear, by definition, essentially that this is again stationary, so translation invariant in distribution, and it will no longer be a Poisson process, of course, but it will be a stationary process of n minus k flats. And the question which we ask here is the following. So say, given the intensity of our hyperplane process, but maybe different direction distributions, for which such x, this given gamma is the intersection density I call this gamma k, and by definition that's the intensity of the section process xk maximal. So once again, we consider all hyperplane processes with given intensity. We take these intersection processes, and as parameter for our variational problem, we have the direction distribution phi. And we ask, for which choices of phi will this intersection density, so here in the sense the density of the points, be maximal? And the problem came up in 74 and was solved in the plane. So there are the only choices, k equal 2, these intersect lines, and was solved in showing that it's maximal if and only if x is isotropic. And the tool for using, for proving this was Fourier series expansions. 10 years later, a student of Josef Mecke covered the channel case, and he observed that the connection between the probabilistic framework in geometry is this relation by Matterhorn, because Matterhorn had also shown that the k-th intersection density is just an intrinsic volume of the associated solenoid of the hyperplane process X. Now we are in business, because now, as you see, immediately the problem of maximizing gamma k given gamma is nothing else but considering this isoparametric ratio, which is the intrinsic volume, the k-th intrinsic volume of the associated solenoid, divided by the mean width, which is k equal 1, it's the first intersection density, so the process itself, to the k, and by the special case of the Alexandrov-Fenchel inequalities, this is maximized by Bohr's, and the nice thing is that this is scaling invariant. And this is again the same if we take a hyperplane process, which is isotropic, and also the equality case becomes clear from this reasoning. So the question is answered, but a new question arises. What about lower bounds? So more explicitly, given gamma, for which I is the intersection density minimal? And it's immediately clear that the answer is this doesn't make sense, because in this isoparametric problem, this minimum will be zero, and in a sense, you can consider line processes where the lines only have two directions, and one direction has high probability, the other very low probability, and then you can arrange this in such a way that the overall intensity is constant, but the intersection density becomes arbitrarily small. And geometrically, this just means you consider rectangles with one long side and one short side, and the isoparametric ratio is arbitrarily small. And now this reminds you of Keith Bohr's reverse isoparametric inequality, and the way to get around this problem, find a reasonable framework for considering such questions, so considering lower bounds. And that's the suggestion I want to make. So maybe just our way of measuring the intersection density by Euclidean terms is not the optimal way, and we should do it in an affine invariant way. And therefore, we define now a kind of affinely inspired, let's put it this way, intersection density gamma k, which is obtained in the usual way. So we take the notion which we have, and we plug in elements alpha from the channel linear group and take the supremum. That was what Keith and many other people already in the 20s of last century did. They made a functional affine invariant by forming such an expression. And now we can ask again, for which x will gamma k of x be minimal? Okay. So here's a theorem. Gamma k of x is greater or equal than 1 over n to the k, n over k, and for k equal 1, we always have equality, so that's trivial. But for k greater or equal 2, equality occurs if and only if the hyperplanes in X attain almost surely exactly n different directions. Okay, what is the geometry behind this? Maybe if you can't read, if I go further down, so I'll move to the next one. So corollary, and that's not a corollary of this theorem because we want to prove this theorem with the corollary. It's corollary of another theorem which I will write down later. So the corollary states something in purely geometric terms, which we will need. But before, maybe I can remind not all of you. So this again is the definition of a solenoid with generating measure mu. And we say the solenoid is generated by an isotropic measure. If mu is isotropic, and this means that this relation holds for all vectors u, because I can omit the brackets. So this is probably well known here, and it immediately implies that the total mass is n. And now the corollary says, let that be a solenoid with isotropic generating measure. Then the jth intrinsic volume of that is bounded from below by n over k. For j equal 1, we have always equality. And if j is greater or equal to, then we have equality if and only if that is a unit cube. This fun with you? Okay, now this turns out to be a special case of a result for mixed volumes. Now we consider solenoids set 1 up to set j with isotropic generating measures. Then the mixed volume of the solenoids and the remaining bodies are just unit balls is bounded from below by the volume of an n minus j dimensional unit ball. So why is this implying that? That's clear. We just choose all these bodies, the same body, and use the relationship between mixed volumes and these intrinsic volumes. That's just a factor, which is the ratio of these two, which gives this relationship. Okay. Now, we have these two results, and actually from this theorem, we get a more general result than this theorem. What is it? Here. Why are you laughing? I'm just in front of the of the blackboard. You're sitting here. Can you enjoy your life? So let's call this A. And then this is theorem B. And this implies that. And there's another theorem C. Which is now again in the spirit of theorem A, but considers a slightly different situation. Now we choose not just one hyperplane process, but k hyperplane processes, which are stationary. But they need not be Poisson. Instead, we assume that they are stochastically independent. Then we can form an intersection process in a similar way as before. We just choose H1 from X1, H2 from X2, and so on, and take the intersections if this is an n minus k flat. And from this, we get an n minus k stationary process, a stationary process of n minus k flats. We can define its intersection density and call this the joint intersection density of these, and modify it again in such a way that it becomes affinely inspired. Namely, by just plugging in affine transformations at each of these hyperplane processes, but different ones. And this gives something which we call gamma of x1 and xk. And this can then be bounded from below by k factorial n over n to the k times n over k. Again, with full information about the equality cases. And there's also a final bit, which is in the same spirit, but now there's a difference. So far, we considered only hyperplane processes. Now we consider hyperplane process X. Everything is stationary. And a line process Y. And the picture is now this. We again define an intersection process, which is now a point process, and can define its affinely inspired intersection density. And this will always be greater or equal 1 over n now. And again, with full information about the equality case. And actually, the proof here uses something in addition to these tools. It also employs Keith Ball's reverse isoprimatic inequality and the Minkowski inequality, and also a special case of this result, namely for j equal to n. Maybe I should point out that for j equal n, Keith Ball had proved such a result in the case where Z is the generating measure is discrete, and it didn't cover the equality cases. Then Lutzak, Yang and Chang proved in 2004 a result for general isotropic measures covering also the equality cases. They considered LP solenoids and proved reverse inequalities, but it seems that considering lower dimensional intrinsic volumes requires different tools, and especially if you pass to mixed volumes. So I will spend some time now to explain the idea of the proof for this result, because that's the geometric key point, in a sense. Okay, the basic idea is to use induction over the dimension. And a nice starting point for this is a formula for mixed volumes, where at least one of the bodies is a solenoid. And we need only the following special case. So in this formula, you integrate over mixed volume of projections, and the mixed volume is taken in lower dimension in a hyperplane. You project the solenoids. I explain this in a moment. And also the ball, which again gives the ball. The number of balls stays the same, but here I pull out one of the bodies and take its generating measures, the mu j. Now pi sub u is the orthogonal projection onto the orthogonal complement of u. And we will also need the capital pi sub u, which is just this projection normalized. And it projects onto the unit sphere of the orthogonal complement of u. Okay, now you can already guess the induction will go inside the integral. But we need something more. We need something which helps us. I'm sorry, for just a moment. So maybe I should remark. So the strategy is now set as a solenoid, and it has generating measure mu. And from this, we pass to which I call, which I call set u, which is pi, little pi u of set. So it's the projection of this solenoid onto a hyperplane. And it has, again, a generating measure, which we can describe explicitly. And I will do this in a moment. And there will be a second step in a moment, because the point is mu is isotropic by assumption, but this will no longer be isotropic. Now, how does mu sub u look like if A is a subset of the perp? Can be written explicitly using this normalized projection. The norm of this projection times the generating measure of mu, and the integration is over the unit sphere, and we take out u and minus u, which I denote in this way. Now, as I said, the problem is, do we have color? Maybe. I don't know whether green is good. Let's try. So this will not be isotropic, but another one will be isotropic, namely if you just put the square here. And that's an easy exercise. And therefore, this measure, which now lives in u perp, has total mass n minus 1. Okay, but we need something else. We need a description of this mixed volume in terms of the underlying data, namely the mu degenerating measures. And this is up to a constant, an integral. So this is the volume of a simplex spent by these vectors. And we integrate with respect to the generating measures of the projections. And this formula is available in textbook form in a nice book by Wolfgang and Rolf, and it's a special case of previous results which Wolfgang proved maybe in the 70s, so sometime like that. Okay, now you see, we can put things together. We start with the mixed volume. We have this representation, and now we just consider this expression here for the moment and estimate it. So this can be transformed into an integral using this definition without the green part. Now we have to take care and use the projections. Sorry, it's J minus one here. J minus one there. And then we have the norms. And we integrate with respect to the mu1, du1, and so on. Then we get an estimate if you replace this by the squares. And then we can go back doing the same kind of argument as we did, and then get that this is finally the mixed volume of some solenoids, set 1, u tilde, set j minus 1, u tilde, and projections of balls. And now I can finish this line here. So we defined a measure mu tilde and generate a solenoid, and that's the object which we use here. Now the nice thing is that they have generating measures which are isotropic, and therefore we are in the game. You can use the induction, which now tells us it's at least kappa n minus 1 minus j minus 1, which is just kappa n minus j. And then we use this under the integral, use that mu sub j has full measure n, and the proof is done. So what is nice about this presentation of the proof is, if you look carefully at this step here, you also get full information about the equality case. So it's something which you should do at home, at your desk, and not in public, and I think I'm just finished with the time. Is this right? So, thanks a lot.